From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up on the program, 1 year ago today, oil was $100 a barrel. A look at where prices might be headed in 2009 later in the program. But first, 17 days. That's how much time George Walker Bush has remaining in office. Today, we look at his legacy.
I, George Walker Bush,
do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten
my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true.
And the facts are that we had 52 months of uninterrupted job growth, the longest in the history of the United States.
Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
If someone committed a crime, they will no longer work in my administration.
We are seizing the initiative from the enemy, and that the troop surge is working.
We are in the midst of a serious financial crisis, and the federal government is responding with decisive action.
President George W. Bush over the past 8 years. Over the next few weeks, we'll look at both the successes and failures of the Bush administration. We begin today with Darren Shaw. He teaches political science at the University of Texas at Austin. He also served on both Bush-Cheney campaigns. Shaw says to understand his legacy, you need to look all the way back to 2001, when George W. Bush first took office.
The president was very focused on tax cuts, obviously, and on reforming the education system. And there's a bit of irony there because he was a Republican president who came in with very, very significant aspirations to increase the level of federal control or involvement in the setting of standards in the educational system.
Looking over these past 8 years, what kind of legacy do you think he actually does leave behind?
Boy, that's a tough question. In political science, we're a little different from historians. What we tend to do is to focus on, when we evaluate presidents, the extent to which they articulate an agenda, get that agenda passed into legislation, follow through on those public policy commitments and statutes and laws that are enacted. And so, you know, for instance, there may be people who have public policy differences with a president like Franklin Roosevelt or more recently Ronald Reagan, but amongst political scientists, they're regarded as very, very effective, good presidents because they meet these sort of objective criteria. You may not like what Roosevelt did, but you know nobody argues that he didn't articulate a vision, that he didn't get that vision passed into law and then follow through on it. It's very hard to sort of think of Bush in those terms. I mean, even using those objective criteria, there's a lot of subjective room for appraisal. You know, early on, he had the tax cuts, he had No Child Left Behind, a controversial but he got it passed, prescription drug plan, reorganization of Homeland Security. But then as you move to the second administration, the two major legislative initiatives, Social Security reform, which was dead on arrival, and immigration reform went nowhere. So it's very mixed even in those terms, setting aside issues like the Iraq War, the war in Afghanistan, questions of expansion of executive authority. I think those things are going to take years, maybe decades, to sort of settle. It's going to take a lot of time. There are people now who can't stand those things and are ready to throw dirt on the grave of the Bush administration, both Bush 1 and Bush 2. I mean, I'm not so sure. I'm just not as convinced that the record is as open and shut as some people seem to think it is at this point.
In the final months of his administration, of course, one of the biggest stories has been the economy, which right now is looking incredibly grim here in the U.S. To what extent do you think that President Bush should be held accountable for that?
Well, presidents are held accountable, whether it's fair or not. I think my sense is that in some ways presidents are overrated with respect to their ability to impact the economy. But boy, when the economy went south, he's just going to get it. Now, is that fair? In many ways, I think it probably is. I mean, as a free market guy and someone who wasn't terribly interested in regulation, a lot of the absence of regulatory policies over some of these Wall Street firms is, you know, it's pretty easy to say, well, look, he did nothing. This was the fundamental problem, lack of oversight, lack of regulation. You know, ergo, Bush was, if not, you know, culpable. Certainly, you know, it happened on his watch. He didn't do anything to stop it. That doesn't strike me as being terribly unfair. you could argue, I think, and as someone who was involved in the Bush campaign in 00 and 04, that he got pretty unlucky in a lot of ways. But, yeah, ultimately, he's going to bear that responsibility. And that's why I think, you know, the President Bush is never going to rise to the level of the great or even near great presidents, even if, you know, Afghanistan and Iraq are flourishing democracies in 50 years. I think that economic legacy is just going to cripple his ability to sort of resurrect his legacy.
Supporters of the president and the president himself have pointed out to the fact that since September 11th, 2001, there have been no terrorist attacks on U.S. soil. Is that something that can be rightly used as indication of his strengths?
I mean, for my money, I think it's as fair as some of the other things are unfair. In other words, one of the things you do with presidents is you play a what-if game. And historians, of course, have written books on this. And if you hold the president accountable for the economy, I think it's reasonable to take, you know, what you have right now, which is the absence of any attacks on the U.S. homeland over this period of time, and give him credit for that. Is it possible that would have happened without Bush, or that a better policy would have achieved the same effect? Maybe, but we don't know.
If you don't mind my asking a personal question, you worked for his campaign. What do you make of the past 8 years?
It's very difficult from a personal perspective to get a handle on this. I have a lot of friends, and I teach here in Austin, obviously, but I have a lot of friends back in Los Angeles in particular, and by and large, they're extremely negative towards the president, and some of them are pretty aggressive. How could you work for this guy? Aren't you ashamed of yourself? And I guess I had confidence in the president. I think that some of the things that happened were absolutely his fault. I don't think he was served well by a lot of people in his administration. In fact, I would make the argument that one of the real problems was a misguided sense of loyalty. There were certain people who, in retrospect, were clearly not loyal to the president, whom he rewarded with service opportunities beyond the time they should have gone. Politically, it was kind of stunning how things deteriorated, I think. In terms of substantive policy, I understood some of the problems at the times with the policy. I supported them. Some of them have not worked out, and you bear culpability for that. And, you know, they make for a lot of second-guessing. But I think at a personal level, this is an honorable man. This is a man who did the best he could. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, it's a much more complex presidency than people, I think, appreciate right now.
Darren Shaw teaches political science at the University of Texas in Austin. Thank you.
Thank you.
When George W. Bush leaves the White House, he and his wife, Laura, will return to Dallas. That's where they lived before he was elected governor of Texas in 1994. It's also where the Bush Library will eventually be built. For more on their future, we're joined now by Colleen McCain-Nelson of the Dallas Morning News. She joins us from Dallas. And Colleen, there have been rumors that the president wanted to retire to the ranch in Crawford, but it was Mrs. Bush who was very insistent about Dallas. What have you heard about their decision?
The president has said that he's no longer the decider in chief, and that he had made the decision to have the ranch kind of be their getaway while he was in the White House. But Laura has long wanted to come back to Dallas. She went to Southern Methodist University, where the library will be, and has been eager to return to the neighborhood where they lived before heading to the governor's mansion.
They're expected to move into a four-bedroom house. That seems rather modest after living at 1600 Pennsylvania Ave.
It's definitely downsizing for them. I've actually seen the house, and it doesn't stand out from other houses in the neighborhood. In fact, compared to some of the mansions in the neighborhood where they'll be living, it is pretty low-key and fairly modest. It's a ranch house. It was built in 1959, and so driving by it, it's not going to wow you, and you're not going to think, well, a former commander-in-chief must live there.
How are the people of Dallas feeling about the Bushes moving back into the neighborhood?
Well, it's a mixed reaction. You don't see either rioting in the streets nor a hero's parade welcoming him back. There's kind of some in between, where I would say the neighborhood he's returning to is fairly friendly confines. This is the same neighborhood where they lived previously, so they have some old friends in the neighborhood, and it is a Republican neighborhood, kind of old money, and so that will be comfortable for them. But there certainly are folks in Dallas who are not excited about the president living here, whether they simply disagree with his politics or the other concerns that I've heard from folks are traffic and terrorists, and just wondering whether having a former president here could It could tie up traffic and also make Dallas a target. And we've also seen protests both at SMU and within the Methodist Church about bringing the library here. So it's an interesting mix of reactions. But as you drive around the neighborhood where they'll be living, you're already seeing some yard signs pop up that say, "Welcome home, W." So the neighborhood itself is trying to give him a warm welcome.
Colleen, I'd like to ask you about something you just mentioned. The George W. Bush Library will be built at Southern Methodist University. It likely won't begin being built for another 2 years, but you mentioned there's been some protests. What's the issue there?
Well, there are concerns about whether this will be kind of a partisan institute. There's going to be both a library and a museum, and then they're also building a separate policy institute at SMU. And professors at SMU have raised concerns about whether this is going to be a legitimate scholarly institution and have said perhaps this would just be a kind of a purveyor of partisan propaganda and not something that would beef up kind of the academic credentials of the university. And so there are concerns about that, and I think people will be watching closely to see what types of folks they hire to lead that institute and what their political leanings are.
As I understand, there were also some concerns that the president's involvement in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan might not be in harmony with Southern Methodist University's philosophy as a Methodist university. What were the thoughts there?
Folks at the university did express concerns about the war and have protested the war and said that they didn't agree with many of the president's policies and didn't agree with the decision to go to war and the way that the wars have been carried out. And so that has contributed to the protests within the university and within the church. And also folks within the church have just questioned whether having a partisan institute or an institute with a particular ideology is appropriate for a religious institution.
Colleen McCain-Nelson of the Dallas Morning News, thank you.
Thank you so much.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. On this day 1 year ago, crude oil prices hit $100 a barrel for the first time ever. As you likely recall, prices continued on an upward spiral, peaking in July at over $140. Then came the financial crisis and the global slowdown. Today, crude oil is about $40 a barrel. Here to discuss this roller coaster ride and to help us understand where oil and gasoline prices may be going in 2009 is Tom Kloza. He's editor-in-chief of Oil Price Information Service, and he keeps tabs on petroleum prices. Welcome to the program, Tom. And this rise, this fall, is this the most volatile price swing you've ever seen?
Yeah, and you know, it's actually become more and more volatile each year during the decade, so that the new normal, so to speak, is a hyperactive market. And I suspect that that'll continue through 2009, maybe not to the great extent of 2008, where you had $115 separating the lows and the highs, but a lot of wild days, 10 and 12% changes in the price of crude oil on any given day.
Why? Why the big swings?
Part of it is that all of the huge money managers that used to have the province of, let's say, just trading in equities, you know, that money has come into commodities. Commodities aren't a gentle place to invest or speculate money, but they're very popular. And beginning in the first few years of this decade, an awful lot of investment money that might ordinarily be parked in sleepy mutual funds for stocks has come into oil. And that's really increased the stakes. It's increased the stakes on the way up, and it's increased the stakes on the way down. You can argue whether or not it's speculative, but there's no question that it makes the pendulum swing much more quickly from fair value to overvalued or from fair value to perhaps undervalued like we are now.
Is this a safe investment for the future?
It's certainly not a safe investment. No. I mean, as much as equities have moved in 2007 and 2008, commodities markets can still have much, much greater percentage moves. It's very difficult to sort of do the kind of analysis that one does for equities with oil. Oil is like red wine. You have a two-buck chuck, which essentially comes out of Saudi Arabia for less than $2 a barrel, and then you have some of your expensive blends that that come out of North America. The Canadian tar sands, for example, probably have a break-even of about $60 a barrel. So it is certainly not an exact science, and there's even more art to investing in oil or funds that invest in oil than there is with equities.
With oil prices so low now, do you think countries and companies are going to be stockpiling it?
Well, that'll be interesting, because it certainly would make sense that one would buy crude oil when it's cheap, and one might even sell it if you've got a strategic reserve when it's expensive. In the last 8 years, we didn't have any such policy. It was really just to continue to buy modest amounts of crude oil, whatever the price. I would not be surprised to see the next administration probably try to add a little bit to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve if prices do remain close to $40 a barrel. The other side of that, though, is, you know, there's room for some sort of temperate sales when prices get out of hand to the upside. And that was something that was taken off the table from 2000, really until the end of 2008. No sales of SPR crude unless there were hurricanes that disrupted the flow of refineries. It wouldn't be used as a weapon or as an effort to sort of temper runaway pricing markets.
Tom, as you look ahead to 2009, where do you see all of this going in terms of gas prices? Do you think we're going to see gas at $1 a gallon?
I don't believe so. You know, there's a tendency within normally conservative oil analysis to really go for the extreme. And I think you have to look at 2008 as something of an aberration, something as the sort of mother of all volatile years. So I think that it's hyperbole to suggest that prices would be less than a dollar at the pump, because you'd have to see crude oil at $20 to $25 to see that number sustained on a nationwide basis. But I also don't believe that we're going back to the $3 and $4 numbers that were quite common in 2007 and 2008. People will still notice and they'll be complaining, because the likelihood is that there will be a 50 or a 75 cent increase in the price of gasoline from winter to spring and summer. But we're not going to see anything as apocalyptic as we saw in 2008.
Tom Kloza is editor-in-chief of Oil Price Information Service, and he also writes a blog called Speaking of Oil. Tom, thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
The price of petroleum-based diesel fuel has also come down quite a bit. It's now about $2.32 a gallon, which is cheaper than the prices offered by some vendors of the more eco-friendly biodiesel. Portland, Oregon-based Lovecraft Biofuel sells kits to convert diesel car engines so they can run on things like vegetable oil. Lovecraft also converts cars on site at a garage here in Los Angeles. When I spoke earlier with Lovecraft owner Tacy Webb, she told me she now has to move out of that location because of a recent downturn in business.
Our sales at retail locations for doing the actual conversions are down, but the rest of our online sales of the kit itself are still strong.
Back last summer, when gas prices were above $4 a gallon, what were you seeing in your business?
We were seeing at least one conversion a day, sometimes a couple. On the weekends, we would have a couple. Saw a lot more corporate vehicles and fleets of vehicles that were interested in converting to save on fuel costs, and a lot of families, too. Now we're seeing strong online sales, especially from the international community, but not people coming in to convert their vehicles like they used to. I'd say our sales are, you know, now at about a couple conversions a week, maybe three conversions a week, which is still great for us, so long as we can focus on just selling our components online.
Have you been able to tell which customers are sticking with it with biodiesel and which might be going back to petrodiesel?
Well, I mean, I would say that our, you know, probably more environmentally minded customers are going to stay with waste, running cars on waste oil, on straight vegetable oil, and on biodiesel. There's definitely a factor and a component where people want to run on a cheaper fuel source, and that customer is dwindling. For me, when someone converts their vehicle to run on alternative fuel sources, what it's really about is just truly being empowered to be independent of these drastic market fluctuations, because obviously prices will go up again. And I think that long term, doing something that's better for the environment, not supporting foreign oil, is the best choice that people can make.
Tacy Webb owns Lovecraft Biofuels. Thank you, Tacy.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen. In a few minutes, Americans are depressed about the economy, but perhaps that's part of the problem. Our pessimism is only making things worse. Find out why in a moment. But first, today at the White House, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice accused Hamas of holding the people of Gaza hostage in its conflict with Israel. She added that the United States was working with its partners to try to bring about a sustainable ceasefire. So far, no concrete progress has been made. With us now is NPR's Mike Schuster. He joins us from Jerusalem. And Mike, are Hamas and Israel still exchanging rocket attacks today?
They are. This is, in fact, the seventh day of the current conflict, so we're now a week into the conflict. There have been intense airstrikes up till now, and that's lessened a bit today. There have been about 30 Israeli airstrikes, mostly against weapons-related targets, places where the Israelis believe that Hamas is storing weapons or hiding weapons. There has also been a lower level of Palestinian rocket attacks. But still, two rockets that were launched from Gaza did hit an apartment building in Ashkelon, which is an Israeli town a few miles north, up the coast north of Gaza. And two people were injured, but no further fatalities on the Israeli side.
There have been reports about protests throughout the Arab world against Israel. What have you been hearing there?
Well, in fact, because today was a day of prayer in the Muslim world and in the Arab world, there were protests after Friday prayers in Cairo, in Amman, Jordan, in Damascus, Syria. Police in Cairo clashed with some of the protesters because some of the protesters were from an Islamic group that has ideological ties to Hamas. Outside the Arab world, there were demonstrations also in Tehran, Iran, and in Istanbul, in Turkey. And there were protests here in the West Bank among Palestinians. And there was one in particular in Ramallah. But some fistfights broke out between Palestinians, some of whom are supporters of Hamas and some of whom are supporters of Fatah, the more secular group that was ousted from Gaza by Hamas.
Mike, what's the latest on the humanitarian situation in Gaza?
I've just come from a briefing by a number of United Nations agencies that are active in Gaza, and the situation they describe is truly horrible. There is a food crisis with shortages of flour, rice, sugar, milk, canned goods, meat. What's getting into Gaza is not enough, the UN officials say, to sustain the population. There are power shortages. The one sole power plant in Gaza is not functioning. There's a water shortage for most of Gaza. Running water comes only 5 to 7 days, according to the UN officials. And the sewage system is terrible. 10 million gallons or so of raw sewage are pouring into the sea every day from Gaza. The system is overwhelmed by the some 2,000 injuries that have been brought to the hospitals over the course of the last week. So the situation sounds quite dire.
There are reports that the Hamas rockets might be able to hit a nuclear plant in the Israeli desert. How much of a concern is that?
Well, first of all, this is a rumor and it's not confirmed. There have been reports, unconfirmed reports, that Hamas has acquired missiles that might reach a town called Dimona in the Negev Desert. But in order to do that, these missiles would have to fly another 20 miles past what is known of their outer range for now. We know that there were some missiles that hit the town of Beersheba a couple of days ago, which is about 24 miles from Gaza. And if they were to reach this town, Dimona, they would have to fly another 20 miles or so. So it's not clear that, in fact, Hamas has these such weapons. But if they did, that would put Israel's sole nuclear reactor within their range, and that's where Israel is believed to have been making nuclear weapons since the 1960s.
NPR's Mike Schuster speaking to us from Jerusalem. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome.
Coming up later on in the program, feeling nervous about the economy? Maybe you've gotten rid of your cable TV or you've cut back on your pricey shoe habit, even though you haven't lost your job. You haven't even taken a pay cut. Well, turns out you might be part of what's causing this global financial meltdown. We'll look into the psychology of spending and thinking good thoughts with NPR's Planet Money and correspondent David Kestenbaum. That's coming up later in the program. From NPR News, it's Day to Day. With the holidays now behind us, the movie studios seem to be resting a bit with just a few scattered releases here and there. To tell us what critics think of some of these new films, here's Mark Jordan Ligon with Slate's Summary Judgment.
Edward Zwick, who has directed historical and political dramas like Glory and Blood Diamond, now brings us the extraordinary true story, Defiance, about a group of Jewish brothers who led a resistance against the Germans during World War II. Liev Schreiber and Daniel Craig star.
We have all chosen this, to live here free like human beings for as long as we can. Every day of freedom is like an act of faith. And if we should die trying to live, then at least we die like human beings.
The nation's critics seem to be split down the middle. Variety complains a potentially exceptional story is told in a flatly unexceptional manner, but Newsday says Defiance, like its subjects, succeeds through sheer tenacity, and Premier finds it exciting, well-acted, touching, and genuine. In limited release, we have the Russian film Cargo 200, set in the 1980s Soviet Union, a corrupt policeman kidnaps a woman and takes her on a terrifying journey. The film is in Russian with English subtitles.
Нет, ученый. Просто мне скажи, есть Бог или нет?
Нет.
Cargo 200 is getting mostly good reviews, but all caution against the harsh grittiness of the story. A disturbing, gleefully black comedy, shouts Variety. The Hollywood Reporter calls it absorbingly unpredictable and original, and the Village Voice warns Cargo 200 is beautifully filmed and completely disturbing. And Hollywood legend Clint Eastwood's latest, Gran Torino, is expanding its release into more markets. The dark actioner features director Eastwood also in front of the camera in what he claims is his last performance. He plays a grouchy, beer-chugging ex-auto worker who reluctantly gets involved in neighborhood gangs.
Why can't you people just leave me alone?
We brought you some shallots to plant in the garden.
I don't want them.
They're perennials. They come back every year.
Look, why are you bringing me all this garbage anyway?
Because you saved Tao.
I didn't save anybody. I just...
You're a hero to the neighborhood.
I'm not a hero.
Too bad they think you are. And that's why they keep bringing you the gifts. Please take them.
Well, they're wrong. No, I just want to be left alone.
The critics all suggest taking Gran Torino for a ride. The Washington Post says it's not to be missed. The Miami Herald raves supremely entertaining and often hilarious. And the New York Post applauds a terrific career-capping role for Eastwood. Well, you know, it's probably for the best that Eastwood won't be talked into bringing his Dirty Harry Make My Day character back to the big screen. It could save us all from one hellish movie marketing campaign. Well, okay, he's almost 80, you know, so he could say on the poster, make my bed, or make my sandwich. Or, you know, maybe he's a little forgetful now and he says, what day is it again? Huh? No? Thank you, Mr. Eastwood. Thank you.
Mark Jordan Ligon is a writer nowhere near 80 years old, living in Los Angeles. This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Cohen. Not to get too new agey on you, but you know, there is that idea that if you truly believe things will get better, then they will. If you subscribe to that belief, now you would think would be a really good time to start envisioning a healthier economy. It's a strategy NPR's Planet Money has been looking into, and here to tell us about it is correspondent David Kestenbaum. Hi, David.
Hi, Alex.
So is there any truth to this idea that we could just shrug this off? We could keep our chins up and all these problems will just go away?
In some ways, yes. I mean, there are definitely real problems out there. But look at what just happened during the holiday season, right? You know, sales at the malls and the stores were way, way off, despite the fact that most people out there still have jobs. But people are afraid anyway, and they're pulling back with their spending.
So people are just overreacting to what they're hearing in the news.
They overreact. You know, it seems to be what happens is that we overreact on both sides. So we overshoot. You know, we get too optimistic. And then in times like this, we get too pessimistic. So before the crisis, you know, people were willing to take on way too much risk. And now we're not willing to take on risk for any reward. This actually came up in a discussion I was having sort of half-jokingly with Russell Roberts, who is an economist at George Mason University.
Wouldn't it be great if we just pretended that there wasn't a crisis? Then we'd all be okay.
I sometimes think that might work.
It could. There's never been a president capable of doing it. Roosevelt tried the happy days are here again strategy. It was a very mixed bag. It did not – the decade of the 30s was started off horribly under Hoover with the Depression, and the recovery was extremely slow.
This sounds familiar, David. This is the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Motto, right?
Right, right. I actually have the tape. Do you want to listen to it? It's kind of interesting to hear it.
Yeah, let's do it.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Now, he was talking about, you know, he was worried about a run on the banks there, and that's real total fear. But it was the same basic idea, you know, which is that you have to have faith in the system for the system to work. And we don't have that kind of fear he's talking about today, but my Planet Money colleague Adam Davidson said the other day, he says, yeah, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself and the underlying factors that are all causing that fear.
Well put. You know, David, I was having almost this exact conversation on New Year's Eve with a friend of mine. She has a young baby. She's a writer in Hollywood, and she's actually doing totally fine right now. She's turning down work. She's employed. But she says, you know what? You never know what's going to happen later, so she's spending as little as possible. Isn't part of her fear totally rational?
It is totally rational, but this is what's called the paradox of thrift. So what's right for one person, we're going to save money, on a large scale is totally insane for the economy. Hmm. So, I mean, I have this fight with my sister, right? She also has her job, and she said to me, you know, we were going to redo the downstairs bathroom, and we're not going to now. And I said, no, you're the problem. You have to redo that bathroom because you know, if you don't redo that bathroom, that guy's going to lose his job. And then he's not going to be able to buy the stuff that your company makes. And it's a downward spiral. So she's being rational because, you know, they have some reason to worry about their job theoretically. But, you know, as a result, this guy who redoes bathrooms could definitely lose his job.
David, so we saw over the holidays retailers drastically reduced prices. That didn't quite work. But if that happens again in 2009, will that get spending going again?
I mean, there's this question, right? Will the ship sort of right itself? Eventually, we lower the prices enough and, you know, more people are unemployed and wages drop so that people will be incented to hire them again. But the concern is this thing called deflation, where if, you know, I want to go buy a coat and it's 60% off, I think, well, I'll wait till next week when it's going to be 70% off. And then everybody waits and it just makes things worse.
Okay, so give us a solution. What's the answer to all of this?
One idea is we could all simultaneously take a drug that would make us go out and spend with abandon.
Nice.
That was Adam Davidson's idea. But the only big idea out there right now is this idea of a stimulus package, which is that if no one is willing to take risks spending, the only person left, the only entity left is the government. And so that's why they're talking about a stimulus package of $700 billion, $800 billion, maybe $1 trillion of government spending to go out there and be the buyer of last resort.
NPR's David Kestenbaum. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
If you want to hear more from our Planet Money team, check out their podcast at npr.org/money. And now another interesting hypothesis. Scientists say they have evidence that a swarm of comets or asteroids could have pummeled the Earth about 13,000 years ago, plunging the northern hemisphere into a 1,000-year-long cold snap. During that time, large North American mammals like the woolly mammoth went extinct. It's also about the time when people in the Middle East invented agriculture. A report published today in Science magazine says the trigger for all of that could have been extraterrestrial. Joining us now to talk about this is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. And Richard, what evidence do they have that an impact triggered this cold snap?
Well, Alex, it all comes down to itty-bitty diamonds. And when I say itty-bitty, I mean microscopic or maybe even too small to see through a microscope. And the group of scientists, there are nine of them, headed by Douglas Kennett at the University of Oregon. And what they did was they looked at a layer of Earth that's about 12,900 years old, and they found what they believe are these tiny, tiny diamonds buried in that layer of Earth. And they say, well, how could those diamonds have gotten there? And their leading hypothesis is some high-pressure, high-temperature impact may have generated those diamonds and left them scattered over, well, they've looked in at least a half a dozen sites across North America, and they see these little diamonds everywhere.
So is there any physical evidence of this kind of impact?
That's one of the problems that they're facing. They do not actually have an impact crater the way we have some ideas of where maybe the giant comet that hit the Earth 65 million years ago and wiped out the dinosaurs. There's some ideas about where that was, but there's no evidence actually of having the Earth actually pummeled by individual giant comets or giant asteroids. So their hypothesis says, well, maybe there were a swarm of these things that hit the atmosphere, they broke up into the atmosphere, and so they ended up having this shockwave material spread around. Presumably they kicked up a bunch of dust and did things like that as these giant airborne explosions hit the Earth, but no, there are no impact craters.
So how could comets bursting in air create an extended cold snap?
Well, that's another question that they would have to answer, and they haven't yet. But certainly, if you put up enough dust, if you create big fires and so on, you know that you can put enough particles in the atmosphere to cool down the Earth, at least for a short period of time. Doing that for 1,000 years or 1,300 years, which is about how long this cold snap lasted, that's a little bit tough to understand.
So if not comets, what else might have caused this sort of cold snap?
Well, there is actually a pretty good and well-established hypothesis about what actually happened 13,000 years ago. There was a giant lake of fresh water that spilled into the North Atlantic. This was sort of leftover water from the last ice age. And all this water affected the ocean circulation in the North Atlantic and stopped a conveyor belt of both water and air that was bringing warm air up from the equatorial regions to higher latitudes. And that's been the leading hypothesis for what caused this event, which is called the Younger Dryas. And so somehow or other, they would have to figure out how the comet impact collision event would fit in with this pretty well-established idea that there was this huge burst of fresh cold water that went into the North Atlantic.
So how will all this get sorted out?
Well, more data are needed, I think, is what scientists are fond of saying, and this is certainly a case where that's true.
NPR science correspondent Richard Harris, thank you.
My pleasure.
Back now with Day to Day. Chances are you've seen a blind person accompanied by a guide dog before, but what about a guide horse, or a service parrot, or a monkey trained to help an agoraphobic? These are the animals Rebecca Skloot wrote about in a piece titled Creature Comforts. It will appear in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Rebecca joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
This piece starts out with a really wonderful little vignette. Children are out trick-or-treating, and they see a woman, and she's accompanied by a black and white adorable miniature horse. And one of the kids says to her, cool costume. But as you write, the woman is blind. The horse is not a costume. It is with her every day to help guide her. Rebecca, why have a guide miniature horse instead of a dog?
There are a lot of reasons for it. And the first reason that miniature horse users give is lifespan. Horses tend to live and work into their 30s, whereas a guide dog will work probably 6 to 8 years total. They're usually not placed with a blind person until they're around 2, and they usually retire around anywhere between 8 and 10. So what that means is that in the life of a blind person, they can go through, you know, many dogs, and some guide dogs just don't work out. But in addition to the longer lifespan, there's also they're herd animals, so they sort of naturally work really well with other people because they're aware of sort of moving in synchronicity with another creature. And they also have incredibly good vision. They see 360 degrees and are actually aware of their surroundings in a way that dogs aren't always, because they're prey animals as opposed to predators. So they're very aware of what goes on above them. Such as, you know, a construction rope or something like that, they might actually notice that before a dogwood.
In this piece, you write about a man named Jim Eggers, and he has bipolar disorder with psychotic tendencies. Could you tell us about his service animal? Her name is Sadie.
Yeah, Sadie is an African gray parrot, so she's a pretty small parrot. And she rides around on his back in a backpack, a bright purple backpack that he's had built around a cage. So she's in a cage on his back, and he is pretty severely bipolar, and he has these psychotic tendencies, and he is often threatening to attack people or actually attacked people in the past. And what Sadie does is she rides around his back, and she can actually sense when he's starting to get upset before he realizes it's even happening. And she'll say, "It's okay, Jim. Calm down, Jim. I'm here, Jim. You're all right, Jim." And she'll just do this in a loop, and she'll talk him down.
According to the Americans with Disabilities Act, service animals are allowed to go wherever their human owners are. But as you write, that's been causing some problems. What's been happening there?
People are just used to dogs. They don't associate parrots, horses, monkeys, ferrets, you know, ducks, goats with service animals. So I think the reaction of a lot of business owners and the general public is often one of suspicion that you're sort of making it up.
It sounds as if some people are just not exactly comfortable with animals being in their businesses. But as you point out, there are also some concerns about health that might be legitimate. You talk about a certain kind of monkey that is known to carry certain types of diseases. I mean, it sounds like there might be some potential problems here.
Pretty much everyone I talked to said horses, birds, you know, ferrets, they don't pose any more of a health risk than dogs and cats do. Monkeys can be a different story, in part because some breeds of monkeys carry viruses that can be deadly to humans. So they carry it, particularly herpes B, which is a virus that has a very minimal effect on the monkey, sort of like cold sores with us. But if a human gets it, it's over 70% fatal, and there's nothing you can really do about it. So this is a fairly, you know, there's good reason to be concerned about that. But the most commonly used monkey for service animals is a capuchin monkey. They're the small sort of organ grinder monkeys. And they've been working with quadriplegics since the early 80s. And, you know, they do things like open bottles and, you know, put food in the microwave and scratch itches. I mean, they're incredible service animals. And they aren't a strain that's usually that carries this sort of virus.
Rebecca, you spent a lot of time with these people and the animals that have been helping them. Is there one moment that stands out to you for something that just was really surprising in terms of what these animals were capable of doing?
Yeah, there were several. And I actually think that the moment that I started the story with, where Anne and her guide miniature horse Panda are walking around their neighborhood, was really, I think, the most striking for me. You know, because I could sort of envision how a horse could help guide a person. But the level at which Panda guides her is really amazing. She, you know, in just a few blocks, I saw her maneuver Anne around things that I, as a person who's sighted, wouldn't have even sort of thought of, like, you know, a drainage ditch in the ground. And one of the things that was sort of striking to me was her use of her hooves. And this is something that Anne sort of pointed out to me later and said, you know, this was kind of a perk that we didn't expect, that you can hear her hooves when she walks. Sort of sounds like someone who's walking in clogs. And she'll walk up to a sidewalk, and as they're walking along, she'll take her hoof and she'll just kind of go, and she'll tap the sidewalk so that Anne knows, oh, here's a step up. At one point, Anne has the horse find her the button to cross, to walk across the street, the walk signal button. She walks up to a pole and she says, "Find the button." And Panda, you know, trotted up to the pole and tapped at the base of the pole. So Anne knew that they were now at the pole. And you can hear all these different tones with Panda's hooves. And it was this little moment where I thought, you know, I sort of registered, wow, this is something that a dog absolutely couldn't do. You can hear when you're on wood. You can hear when you're on leaves. You can hear a pitch change in any terrain that you're on, which added this whole element to working with this horse that, you know, Anne had never experienced with a dog. So that was one moment where I sort of, you know, that wasn't necessarily an ability that the horse had. It was just something that Panda's trainer, you know, in the process of training her, they realized, hey, this is something that, you know, we can really work with. And they sort of took advantage of it.
Rebecca Skloot's piece, Creature Comforts, will appear in the Sunday New York Times Magazine. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you.
If you'd like to see photographs of Panda the horse, Sadie the parrot, and a service monkey named Richard, go to our blog. It's npr.org/daydreaming. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen.